It's Your Money with the investor coach, Paul Nichols, the show that pulls back the curtain on the financial services industry and exposes the truth about the traditional financial planning model. Paul believes education plus understanding leads to clarity and confidence that can and will lead to peace of mind. He uses simple solutions grounded in academic research from leading financial minds at Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and the University of Chicago, including several Nobel laureates. You do not need to know everything if you have an investor coach teaching you the few right things. Paul Nichols is the president of Financial Abundance, a registered investment advisor. He is a member of the National Ethics Bureau, the Better Business Bureau, and member of Strategic Coach Quarterly. Get ready for some common sense clarity coaching with the investor coach, Paul Nichols.
Well, welcome to the show. This is Paul Nichols, the investor coach. I hope this finds you well on this Saturday morning. It is wintertime here in central Pennsylvania, and I am excited today because I have a special show. We are really going to focus in an area that there's a lot of misinformation and a lot of misunderstanding over, and that is the area of life insurance. And I've got a special guest I'm going to bring on today, or been kind enough to join us, and Luke will not be with us today. He'll be joining us after the first of the year, but I've got a special guest that I wanted to bring on, someone that I've known for a few years now and respect, has a tremendous business acumen, as well as an understanding of insurance that I have not found in very few people that I know, and mainly because of his function. Ben Nevigen is joining us from San Diego. Ben is the Vice President of Marketing at Life Pro Financial, which is an organization that focuses on supporting financial people around the country. What's interesting about Ben's job and why I asked him to come on the show was the fact that he goes and studies, meets with the actual companies, studies all the products, the intricacies, the ins and outs, sees how they can apply to certain strategies, and then really brings advisors like me and other advisors around the country those strategies or those products via life insurance type of products that they make, and allows us to incorporate certain strategies. So Ben has an understanding very few people I know of as it relates to insurance. So Ben Nevigen, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you. How's the weather?
Weather's great. As you know, I'm here in Southern California. I'm looking out my window. It's a little cool. You know, it's about 60 degrees, so I'm sure you can identify with that.
Well, yeah, yeah. I've looked out that window. You can see the beach, actually, the ocean from his window. So don't.
You know what's ironic, Paul, is I'm looking out there, and the MetLife blimp is flying overhead.
Oh, is that right? There must be a game. Well, they got bowl games and stuff coming up.
Yeah, something like that, or Torrey Pines might be having a tournament. I'm not sure.
Oh, yeah, maybe Tigers out there, huh?
Yeah, I hope not.
Well, hey, we're going to talk about the strength and security of life insurance, and really how someone can make it work for them. And I have to set this up by saying, Ben, you're not familiar. I know you're originally from New Hampshire, but here in central PA, there's a strong, we're in a university town, obviously, with Penn State, but there's a strong, what we call Pennsylvania Dutch influence, which is really, I found out just recently, like in the Amish, they're actually opposed to insurance, which is kind of an interesting thing. But a lot of people out here don't understand it, and those that do understand it think of it only as death benefits. So what I wanted to do was spend some time talking about the safety of insurance and the benefits, and then uses and strategies. And let's just start with the safety, because I know you know the history quite well.
Well, I do, and this might appeal a little bit to your audience. You know, I'm kind of a student of history myself, and believe me, when I got out of college, I never thought I was going to be studying life insurance. Talk about boring. But the more and more my position allowed for me to get into it, the more interested I became. And I'll tell you, it's got a really rich history, Paul. And I think any discussion on the safety and the security of insurance really has to begin, so to speak, at the beginning. You know, historians tell us that insurance has its roots really in the beginning of civilization. You know, they've looked back and seen that it started, you know, before the Babylonians, before the ancient Romans, and really ancient China, where a lot of the merchants would divvy up their cargoes among several different ships. That way they were spreading the risk. If one ship was attacked by marauding pirates, they'd at least get a portion of their cargo to where its final destination was. That was really the birth of insurance. It wasn't until the Romans, however, where we saw really the birth of life insurance, where it was documented. The Romans had a practice called, and for those of you that studied Latin, sepultura stipes. And what that meant was burial clubs. The Romans had a superstition, if you will, and they were afraid that if their dead weren't buried properly, you know, those spirits would come back and haunt them. So the rich and the poor would pool their money to make sure that that didn't happen. You know, we all know what happened to Rome, and as Rome burned, really so did the concept of life insurance, and we didn't see that again until probably the 17th century in England. There was a coffee shop by the name of Edward Lloyd's Coffee House, where we saw a lot of the wealthy merchants and ship owners and upper middle class were gathering together. And through this, they were congregating, and believe it or not, they were developing the form of life insurance that we know of today. You know, the merchants would go to some of these more wealthy people, and they would have them take for a premium some of the risk, and they would insure, and they'd do that by writing their names one under another and putting beside it how much they would insure the various cargoes and the lives of the captains and the crew and so on. And by doing this practice is really where we got the term underwriters. Now, it's funny, Paul, that you say that you have a large Amish community there that doesn't believe in life insurance, because during that time, throughout the Middle Ages, life insurance was illegal in most of Europe. In fact, it was England was the only place that really saw the benefits of it and had a common practice of it. And I'll tell you why it was like that in England, and I don't know if this has something to do with distrust of it or the unliking of it in your community, but there was a huge gambling element that this attracted. And at Lloyd's Coffee House there, it actually started to attract a lot of the English gambling community. And what they would do, believe it or not, is they would look in the newspapers, and when a prominent duchess or knight or what have you was shown in the paper as having some type of an illness, they would take out essentially a term life insurance policy on them. And if, in fact, that duchess or whoever passed away within that term life, a death benefit would be paid. This is really the first place that we see stranger-originated life insurance. Well, you know, the Parliament kind of got wind of this, and in, I believe, it was 1974, they actually stepped in and they forbade this. And really we see the first signs and really the first case of government coming in, seeing the benefits of insurance and protecting it with regulation. We see that as we go on through the years. Now, an interesting side note is there was quite a few of those merchantmen and those underwriters broke away to form in 1769 something called the Real or the New Lloyds. We know Lloyds today now as Lloyds of London,
right.
And they have a rich history in the community, in the marketplace, though they're not so influential with life insurance these days, more property and casualty. Now, what happened after that, we all know, is the New World was colonized and insurance came over to the American colonies, and we had our very first settlement in Charleston, South Carolina. And again, insurance kind of had a nefarious connotation, if you will, because it was there that many of the rich land barons, they were insuring their slaves. And there's documentation for some of the older insurance companies where they actually had some of that on their books. It was really the first time where we ever saw kind of a key man policy. And I start to think that, you know, my boss has a key man policy on me. I don't know what that means.
Well, for people who don't understand, a key man would be in a business environment. If you had a very important employee, you might, like a VP of some kind, you might insure their lives in case they passed away. You could take care of their beneficiaries and then have money to find a new guy or gal.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. And insurance kind of took off from there, Paul. It was mostly done in Philadelphia and New York. And New York really became the hub, and to an extent is still today, and really the policy setters of insurance practices, life insurance practices. For instance, you know, really in the 1800s, insurance took off, and we had something, you know, we didn't have women's suffrage here until the 20th century.
Right.
And back then, the government realized, and the New York legislation realized that, well, who's the biggest benefit for life insurance? Well, it's women, yeah. Widows, and it was, you know,
children,
orphans.
Yeah.
However, women couldn't own contracts. They couldn't own land. They couldn't own contracts. And so at the time, that was a real conundrum for these life insurance companies, and legislation and the New York government kind of saw that. And what they did was they changed it with the Married Women's Act of 1840, where they allowed women to actually own life insurance contracts.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see insurance really did some good things for our nation, and they were really some of the things that was really one of the first pieces that we've seen of women's suffrage. We also had a huge shift in the 1800s from corporate structure to mutualization. You know, today we talk about mutual companies. I think you've done business with a few mutual companies,
mm-hmm.
Paul.
And mutual companies, like them in general, and they're basically, the idea is that they're mutually owned by all the policy holders, right, Ben?
That's exactly right. You see, back in 1837, there was a financial crisis. We don't really talk about that too much. Mostly we're focusing on the 1930s and that financial crisis. But in 1837, we had a similar one. And after, it left us with really no investors. People didn't want to invest in large insurance companies. So we turned to this thing called mutualization. Mutuality, like Paul just explained, is whereby you have the policy holders which actually own the company. This required little initial capital, and we relied mostly on the premium payments from high volume sales to pay those death claims and to pay the administration. So it was a little bit more expensive, but that's really where we saw that birth of mutuality and really where life insurance took off.
Back in the 1830s. Now,
yeah.
We got about 4 minutes as we move forward into from the 1830s, and that's when you say that it really started to take hold as a real planning tool for people.
Exactly. It certainly did, and we had some more regulation in there. After that, you know, the mutual companies, they blew up, and we were having more and more insurance sold. And because of that, it became easy to establish these insurance companies. So the government steps in again and puts more regulation into place. For instance, they required that we had to have $100,000 at the time of capital stock, which is really the first time we see legal reserves
mm-hmm.
being required.
Right.
We also see that the companies had to put up $100,000 with the comptrollers of New York and later the other states, which is where we see the first signs of guarantee funds, state guarantee funds, another thing that makes today's insurance so strong and beneficial. And this kind of sprinkled right throughout the whole insurance community. One of the things that we actually saw was the Armstrong investigation in 1905, and this was really the third piece of legislation which really made insurance such a strong financial product. We had New York Life at the time, the Equitable and Mutual Life, which had kind of teamed up with some investment bankers, and they were spending wildly. They were investing in these very speculative deals because insurance, you know, they had large pools of money that they weren't going to be called for a long period of time. So we had this Armstrong investigation. Really, the community was up in arms, and because of that, we developed something called the NAIC, which we still have today, which is the National Association of Insurance Companies. Insurance is regulated on a state level, but they all come together, and they applied legislation whereby they said, look, insurance companies, you have to be invested in safe, secure products, i.e. government bonds. It eliminated a lot of these practices that had got them into trouble. And it really democratized the management rule, and it did this all by law, whereby today we can look and we can see if we're doing business with a legal reserve life insurance company, we're doing business with a very safe, secure, and state-backed company that has so many safety nets surrounding it that we're doing business with a very strong financial institution.
Can you speak real quick, we got about a minute and a half left, on the difference between policyholder and a shareholder?
Yeah, I would love to, actually. The difference, really, when you have a policyholder, you've got regulation. You've got your company is mandated, the insurance company is mandated to have their legal reserves invested in grade A bonds, 90 to 95%. In fact, the higher the grade of the bond, the lower the percentage of the portfolio has to be allocated, and it's a percentage. So needless to say, you've got some protection. A legal reserve carrier, for every dollar, that carrier must have approximately $1.4 in reserves. So regardless of your AM Best rating, a legal reserve protects you. On the flip side, we've got a stockholder, which is compensated by assets. the values of stock and market risk. On that stockholder side, it could be described as a gamble, where on a policyholder side, we don't, by law, it's not allowed to be gambled. So when we take a look at AIG, for example, that's something that a lot of people, probably a lot of your listeners are familiar with. AIG was the holding company for their life insurance wing, which was American General. American General's investments couldn't have been tied up into those mortgage-backed securities. They had to be in these high-grade bonds, and because of that, everybody that had an American General policy still has all those guarantees that they were promised. Where on the other side, a stockholder of AIG, well, we all know, you know, where they were sitting.
Right, so it makes the point that insurance companies are very, very, very safe. In fact, I've got a $1 million policy with AIG. But we're talking about safety. I'm talking to Ben Navigens with LifePro from San Diego. We've got to take a quick break. You're listening to It's Your Money, the investor coach, Paul Nichols. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the show. This is Paul Nichols, the investor coach. We believe that education plus understanding leads to clarity and confidence that can result in peace of mind. And we want to bring some clarity and hopefully some confidence to the whole subject of life insurance. I'm joined by Ben Navigens, who's a VP, Vice President of Marketing with LifePro Financial out of San Diego, a company that's focused is supporting financial advisors around the country, studying products and companies and so on and so forth. And we left off in the last segment talking about safety and the history, which was really quite enlightening, Ben, that chronology that you went through. I think it's going to be helpful to a lot of people. But this section, we really want to focus on the benefits of life insurance because so few people really understand them. And I think we should start off with the fact that, you know, people talk about safety. Insurance is extremely safe, really, because of the government. So can you speak to that a little bit? I think most people, when I say that, they go, what? Insurance is safe because of the government?
Yeah, exactly. It kind of doesn't sound right. It doesn't exactly roll off the tongue. But you're exactly right. And this is something that the government has understood for a long time. And they've given us certain benefits because of it. And really, when we talk about insurance, you think of it as just a death benefit. But there's a lot more that's built inside and inside of insurance contracts. And it's kind of like, you know, I talk about it to the people that I work with, uncovering these hidden benefits, because they're not in plain sight. You know, the government, like I alluded to before, they know that it's in their best interest to have us as citizens protect our own families while we're alive and after we're gone, and to continue to provide for them. Why? Because the government, they don't want to be having to pay for widows and orphans that are left behind. They don't want those widows and orphans on welfare. You know, that we have enough expenses in our government. They want to incent us to take care of our own families long after we're gone. And how do they do that? They do that with these certain benefits. And I call them really their lifetime benefits. The government, believe it or not, because of some sections in the IRS code, allows us to accumulate money in our insurance contracts. And now, Paul, I'm not talking about term insurance. I'm talking about permanent insurance right now.
Right.
And a lot of people will say, well, you know, you should go with term insurance because term insurance is the cheapest way to do it. And it is, but it's really like renting insurance. And once, you know, the end of your term is over, you don't necessarily get those premiums back. And if you didn't die, there was no benefit paid out. So you don't really have anything.
By the way, you know what percentage of term policies ever pay a death benefit?
It is very low.
Less than 1%.
Exactly. That's why the insurance companies are in business.
Right.
You know, they know that. But what I'm talking about here is permanent insurance, because there's some benefits built into that. And people don't understand it. And that's why you kind of have the Susie Ormans of the world that don't necessarily like it, to put it lightly, because they don't understand. And the IRS codes that have been put into place really allow us some tremendous benefits. For instance, you know, we have something called Section 7702, which allows the cash accumulation inside our life insurance contracts to grow tax-deferred, real similar to your 401k, just like your IRAs. However, we've also got another benefit, which is in IRS code 72E, which allows us, access to that money after it's grown tax deferred on a tax-favored basis. And I'll tell you, Paul, tax-favored means tax-free.
To me.
We're allowed to access that money as long as we've structured our policies correctly within some other IRS guidelines that I know that you're aware of and many professionals out there are also aware of. But if structured correctly, we're allowed to take our money out on a tax-free basis in the form of loans. And I'll tell you, there's no other financial product out there that I know of, except for maybe the Roth IRA, which has its own limitations, but there's no other product out there that I know of that allows you to grow tax-deferred income and take it out on a tax-free basis.
Nor is there any other vehicle out there that you know what your economic benefit's going to be.
Exactly.
Whether you're, that's what a lot of people don't understand, Ben. They think it's only about death. But if your economic, whatever your death benefit is, you can get that out while you're alive.
Absolutely.
People don't realize that. They don't realize that more sophisticated, it comes from the E.F. Hutton story. I don't know if you have time. Can you tell that story? That might lead in. I don't want to throw you off there, but.
No, I certainly can. What happened was, you know, back in 1978, FTC did a study. And, you know, a lot of people don't know about life insurance because it's got a bad connotation. Let's call a spade a spade. It's got a negative connotation, and it's because of some bad practices in the past. The FTC did a study in 1978. It was a 17-month study, and what they found was policyholders on these whole life contracts were receiving about a 1.3% rate of return. Now think back to that time, Paul. The rest of the nation was earning about a 13% rate of return on their other investments. So this really got a negative name. It was right around that same time that a company right down here, real close to us in Southern California, by the name of E.F. Hutton, which was not a life insurance company, recognized some of these tax codes and recognized some of these benefits, and they created something called Flexible Premium Adjustable Life. You and I know it now as Universal Life. And at the time, there wasn't really a lot of guidelines around them, and people were able to purchase a life insurance contract with a death benefit of a very small amount, say $50,000, but they could, because this was a flexible premium, they could put more into this policy than just that cost of insurance. The savvy investors, what they were doing was they were abusing it. They were putting tons and tons and tons of premium in there. Very little of it was going towards that cost of insurance, and they were receiving huge amounts of benefits in tax deferral and then tax-free income. And contracts that were put in force back in those days are still active today, and people really are doing well with them. What happened was right around 1982, we had some legislation. TEFRA is something that we saw. It actually stands for the Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act of 1982. And then DEFRA, the Deficit Reduction Act in 1984, these things came out and they limited your insurance contract. Essentially what they did is they defined the corridor. They said, no, 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 if you're going to put this much more money in than the death benefit, then what's going to happen is we're going to call this an investment. No longer are you going to have these benefits.
Now, Ben, just so people know, the legislation came as a result of the fact that the IRS had called E.F. Hutton on this deal, right?
Yep.
And then E.F. Hutton, IRS took E.F. Hutton to court, the way I understand it.
Exactly.
And then E.F. Hutton won the case, and the IRS went to Congress and said, we got to legislate these.
It's exactly what happened. And, you know, a lot of us in the industry, we think, oh, man, darn that, TEFRA and DEFRA. But I'll tell you what it did, Paul. It took this, so to speak, loophole, and it made it into a legitimate
Absolutely.
Investment.
No question about it.
And really what it did as well is now we've got, you know, this ability to, I mentioned there's some limitations in your Roth. You know, there's, your contributions are limited. If you make over a certain amount of money, you can't make contributions.
Accessibility is strings attached to.
Exactly, and you don't have that with a life insurance contract.
And you know what the life insurance contract return's going to be.
Right,
the
and their returns,
benefit.
Now keep in mind you do have to pay for that cost of insurance,
sure,
and
sure.
TEFRA and DEFRA make us actually have a insurance contract in there. But these are long-term investments, like your 401k, like your IRA. We're not looking at accessing these in 4 years, 5 years. These are retirement investments, and as we do the studies, which we do over here quite a bit, I think we've shared them with you, but the products out there today, and because of the competitive nature of, you know, our economy, and the community, the insurance community, these products work very well, and we're seeing that the actual internal rate of return, we're achieving upwards from 6.5% to sometimes 7.5-8% on those.
So what Ben's saying, folks, for those of you that you know are more layman to this, is that their tax codes are set up that you can fund these contracts in a very specific way, and you can put a lot of cash in them, more than the cost of the insurance that the death benefit you would be buying. So many times what we're doing is using those for retirement accounts, in that what we're doing is going in and squeezing down a death benefit because we're not that concerned about the death benefit. We want it. We want the chassis of the insurance, and then accumulating a lot of cash in those for a tax-free retirement income stream. And it's all legal. It's all within the tax codes. And I'll tell you, you know, I've said it before many, many times, Ben. It always interests me that these rich politicians will stand up and say tax the rich when they are. Well, they know about these. I have not dealt with too many predominantly wealthy. I don't mean rich. I mean wealthy people that do not have an awful lot of money in these types of contracts. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And to go back to your point too, Paul, you wonder why these things are so safe and secure. Well, who are the purchasers of these government bonds? It's insurance companies. So the government knows, you know, it's a great symbiotic system that we have here. Also, who purchases life insurance contracts for these reasons that we're talking about? It's the people that understand that, you know, the people that are on Capitol Hill. These aren't going anywhere. They perform a tremendous service, and the benefit works so well for everyone who understands them.
So now some of you out there might be saying, well, this sounds too good to be true. It's not. There's cost and underwriting and different things involved. And, you know, that's where you need to talk to your advisor. You may be wondering, though, why has my advisor not brought this to my attention, especially if you have any type of tax issue moving forward? And maybe you can talk to that, Ben, because I think a lot of guys are missing the bus on this deal.
You know, and I ask myself that question all the time. How come more people don't do this, don't understand this? And I think really, Paul, it's a lack of education. And, you know, insurance gets a bad rap, has had a bad rap in the past, and people, for those reasons, don't take the time to really understand the benefits of it. You know, the professionals that we work with, we teach them on these, and their clients really enjoy the benefits of these, and I know that you're a proponent of these in a lot of the business that you do.
Well, and also, I think it's important, ladies and gentlemen, that you all understand, I go out to San Diego on a fairly regular basis for a mastermind group that we have, and these are, I don't know, 20 or so producers from around the country that all have substantial practices. You know, those of us that are employing this isn't like a... you know, the insurance guy or the car salesman, for lack of a better picture. I mean, this is more sophisticated estate planning strategies that have really been brought to the masses of the middle class through education. But why more advisors? Well, you know, the fact of the matter, Ben, how many guys are willing to, you know, spend some money, hop on a plane to go learn about new strategies? I don't see that many guys that are willing to do it to start with.
Nope, you're exactly right, and that's why. They're not willing to take the time to see that. And it goes back again to your point that, you know, it's not used car salesmen that are, or these guys that are out there just peddling life insurance. It's your financial advisors. It's people like you that look
tax
at a
attorneys,
very holistic
yeah.
view and understand that this is a tremendous tool if used correctly.
Yes, and so when we're talking about life insurance in the way that we're using it, and there's lots of different strategies and uses for it, and we want to save that for the next segment, but let's talk about performance just for a moment. I think one of the reasons, and you don't want to get hung up on performance because it's not all about yield. That's where a lot of people miss it when they talk about finances. They think it's all about yield. No, it's all about beginning with the end in mind. What are we trying to accomplish? You know, it's like, you know, I'm a big proponent of the market. We manage money. But I'll tell you that most people out there aren't getting near the kind of returns that they think they are in the market compared to what long-term steady eddy type insurance returns have been. Can you speak to that in the next minute or so?
Yeah, I sure can. Paul, you know, I think it's important to always have a very diversified portfolio. But, you know, if you think about the year that we just went through and what people's accumulation and their portfolio looks like now, and those people that were not diversified, well, they're suffering right now. That's why it's important to have products like these which offer us guarantees. It's not always important to get a return on your dollar. It's important to get a return of your dollar. For those of us, or for those for some of your listeners that were coming up to retirement, you know, could they really afford to lose 40%? I lost 40% in my 401k. I'm pretty young, I can afford to make that up. But I tell you what, I'm not putting all my money into a 401k anymore, and especially the closer I get to retirement, I'm looking to have safe and guaranteed returns. The other thing that I know, and we can talk about this more in the next segment, but you know, you have to look at where the country's going and where taxation is most likely going and where we know it's going. And I would rather, you know, take some ownership, pay my tax a little bit now where I know where it is, allow my money to grow tax deferred, and allow access to it tax free. I think it's the old adage, do you want to pay tax on the seed or the harvest, especially when you know the tax is going to be greater at harvest time than what it is right now. That's what these types of products bring to the table.
We're talking to Ben Nevigens, Vice President of Marketing at LifePro. He studies life insurance plans and companies and really understands these strategies and products. And you're listening to Paul Nichols with It's Your Money. We will be right back after the break. When we come back, we're going to talk about strategies we use for insurance. Welcome back to the show. This is Paul Nichols, your host. You're listening to It's Your Money, which is part of Coach's Corner. We endeavor to pull back the curtain on financial matters that are important to you and expose the truth about money and investing, because we believe education plus understanding leads to clarity and confidence that can result in peace of mind. And today, this Saturday, we are trying to bring some clarity to the area of life insurance, which is a dark cloud for most people, because when they think about life insurance, they're only thinking about one thing, and that's death. And so we've been fortunate enough to have Ben Nevigens, VP of Marketing from LifePro Financial Services out in San Diego, California, who's an expert, in my opinion. I've known him for a few years, an expert in the area of life insurance, whether it be the history or background, whatever it is. And we're talking about safety earlier, then we talked about benefits, but now we want to talk about the uses. And when most people think of life insurance, they shouldn't call it life insurance, they should call it death insurance, really, because that's what most people think of. When you start looking at uses and strategies, Ben, of life insurance, and this would require, the average or better advisor. I mean, this isn't the newbie, the new insurance guy isn't going to understand this stuff that we're talking about.
No, you're right. Probably not. The new insurance advisor is probably going to understand it, as you said, as death insurance. And I'll tell you what, there's nothing wrong with that, because that certainly plays a vital role in our community, and that's that life insurance. Because of Section 101A in the IRS code, the death benefit transfers to our heirs income tax-free. Not only that, but that death benefit is out of the estate of whomever was the insured, so the creditors can't go after that amount either. And that death benefit is, it's noble, and it's a great privilege of this life insurance. You know, income replacement is a big thing, and we work with a lot of people that use life insurance for just that. You know, we ask, or they will ask a client of theirs, what are you going to need to live on to remain in your own world should your spouse pass away? What rate of return do you think you can get? And what you really do, Paul, on that is you reverse engineer it. You know, we'll ask a client, how much do you need a month to live on? And maybe that answer is, well, $6,000. Well, that's $72,000 a year that you actually need to remain in your own world, to not have to rely on charity, to not have to move out of your house, to not have to rely on family. You need $72,000 a year to protect yourself. We divide that by that rate of return that we think we can get. Let's say, for instance, 6%. You need a death benefit of $1.2 million, and that's just simple math, and that is a great use of life insurance. You know, it's great for families starting out, and I'll tell you a personal story. When I first had my daughter, I got a term insurance policy. I was new in the industry. I didn't understand all the other benefits, but I knew that if anything happened to me, I needed to make sure that my daughter could go to college and would be protected. I also needed to make sure that, you know, my mortgage would be paid, my wife wouldn't have to worry about moving out of the house and getting a job and doing something else. And that was a need that I would have over a period of time, and that's how I accomplished it. And there's nothing wrong with it.
No, you make me think of, I'm a like you, a history buff, a history guy, and I'm a big fan of Will Rogers. And I remember reading a quote that went something to the effect, he was a big proponent of life insurance and real estate, Will Rogers was. And he said something like, for the fellow that doesn't believe in life insurance, he should be forced to come back and see the mess that he's left.
Oh, man.
Something like that. Have you heard this before, the quote from him?
You couldn't have said it better. And, you know, it's really a very selfless purchase, and it's very it's hard because you don't want to think about those things.
Well, and you know what's interesting, Ben? I'm very rarely are we getting into, you know, kind of the negative stuff. It's more what's the value of life? You know, what's the value of life worth? But when we look at insurance strategies, I mean, death planning benefit alone to itself is a real small part of the bigger picture of uses and strategies for life insurance, right?
It's tiny. But I think you need to discuss it to have that conversation, because really that's the reason that the government has granted us so many privileges. But you're right. When you look at the actual ways and the strategies that life insurance can be used, there's more benefit in the living benefits than there are in the death benefits.
Yeah, there's different ways to do it. We use a lot of these different strategies. And maybe we can talk a little about a couple of uses for life insurance. Obviously, there would be the guy that walks in the office and says, you know, here's X amount of dollars. I want the biggest death benefit I can get. Well, that's just a death benefit play. That would be for, like you said, protection for his family or whatever. But then you might have another fellow that comes in the office that that does well financially, and he's got a tax issue.
Mm-hmm.
So where might a guy that has a tax issue use insurance to his benefit?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things that you might look at is, for instance, the estate taxes, and that's kind of a hot topic right now. We know that currently that's being discussed on Capitol Hill. We've got, you know, I think it was the House last week that passed a permanent estate tax exemption of $3.5 million, meaning that anybody who has an estate over 3.5, well, they're not going to have to pay estate taxes, which are 45%, by the way, up to 3.5. Now, the House passed that. The Senate has not. If they don't, it goes to 2010, and because of the Bush tax cuts, we have the estate taxes repealed, which means there isn't going to be any taxes, which means if somebody's close, there might be a lot of plugs pulled that year. I don't think it's going to get to that. But the reset in 2011 means only $1 million is going to be exempted. Anything over $1 million, you're going to pay 55% on in state taxes, over half the amount of inheritance that's left to you over $1 million is going to the government. How do you protect yourself from that? Well, you do it with life insurance, and that's exactly kind of, I think, what you're alluding to, Paul, something called a survivorship or a second-to-die policy, which pays that tax bill upon the death of the estate owners.
And by the way, so we've talked about death is one use of life insurance. Estate taxes. Now, just to bring it into layman's a little bit more, ladies and gentlemen, estate taxes are the total value of everything that you own upon your death to your heirs. Would be, that's the estate. And I had a friend, and there's shows on iTunes you can listen to, Alan Ugulis, an attorney who specializes in this area, who told me the IRS, all of a sudden your junk becomes antiques when they go through to figure out the price of everything. So it doesn't take that much to get to that number when you start looking at land and other things. But anything above that millions is subject to a 45% tax, unless the Senate passes this $3.5 million number, which is more palatable. It's where it should be. But but death benefit can be used to handle that tax for your family. And that's especially pertinent in our area, ladies and gentlemen, because we have a lot of folks in our area that are land rich, but not necessarily cash rich, in that they have a lot of farmers. So you look at the value of some of these farms, you know, it's not uncommon to hear of kids that have to sell the farm they don't want to sell in order to cover the tax bill. Well, pennies on the dollar can ensure that doesn't happen by using life insurance to pay the estate taxes. So those are two ways, Ben, death and estate taxes. But I was referring more to the live-on benefits and the strategies that you and I have employed personally to ensure that we have a lower tax burden down the road.
Exactly. And those live-on benefits, I mean, really, that's the person that walks into the office and says, you know, I have a need in retirement. And, you know, health care isn't going to be the biggest expense in retirement. Taxes are going to be the biggest expense in retirement, especially if you kind of look at the expenditures right now. 2008 federal expenditures, by the way, were $2.9 trillion. On the flip side, the federal income of 2008 was $2.5 trillion. Numbers haven't come in yet for 2009, but if you just compare that 2.9 expense and 2.5 income, that's a $400 billion annual deficit on top of our current federal deficit of somewhere around $12.1 trillion. And what's interesting is, for those of you that are familiar with David Walker, the former Comptroller General and the head of the Government Accountability Organization, he said, Paul, and this is a quote, "We are heading for a future where we will have to double federal taxes or cut federal spending by 60%. I'm going to tell you that I don't see the government cutting federal spending by 60%. Not with, you know, we've got Afghanistan, which is going to continue to go on for a while. We've got health care coming up. There are huge expenses. There's no way. So what's the government going to have to do? They're going to have to generate revenue. And what does that mean? In layman's term, that's taxes.
Well, so, you know, the other the thing that's scarier, just on this subject, let me spin it for a second, is the fact that they're also creating an environment right now that's not conducive for business people to go out and innovate and create. And the only thing that ever brings us out of recessions is innovation. It's the only thing that's ever done it in our country. That's what makes our country great. But if the environment for business people is harder to do business in, i.e. the health care plan, I had Congressman Thompson on last week, I'm a small business owner. They're going to I'm going to be forced to provide health care, which I have no problem doing that, but it's got to come from the profit margin somewhere, or I pay a fine. So, you know, ladies and gentlemen, moving forward, I guess the bigger picture, what you're pointing to, Ben, and I totally agree, is I do not believe taxes are going to go down. I believe that they're going to be higher. And even if they are the same or lower, it's going to be the biggest tax bill. This is where the industry drops the ball. Ben, they focus on accumulation rather than beginning with the end in mind.
Exactly.
You know, maybe you can speak to that.
Well, you're right. We've got to take care of ourselves, because who knows? The government's not doing it. And to do that, we've got to look at some of these alternative strategies. And that's exactly what we're talking about here. If we've got the ability that's been given to us to grow our dollar on a tax-deferred basis and then gain access to it on a tax-free basis and not have to worry about what the government's doing and what tax bracket we're going to be at and how much of our piece of the pie they're going to take, then we owe it to ourselves to do that, to seek out these alternative strategies, and this is exactly that. We've been given the benefits. Shame on us if we don't take advantage of it.
You know, let's talk a little bit about, just a few minutes we have left, Ben, sources that people can go to get information, because there's not that many good sources out there. When I say good sources, I mean people that are thinking outside of the box. I often tell the story of Time Warner Books when they published Doug Andrews' best-selling book, Last Chance Millionaire, and that they put all the transcripts that they get on a monthly basis in one pile, and Doug's book was totally separate from all them. They put more money behind the launch of that book than any other book outside of business book besides Rich Dad, Poor Dad, because they realized how contrarian but true that it was, and we need to get people to start, besides what I do on the radio and TV and blogs and all that, you know, I'm one of a small group and growing group of financial professionals in this country that are deeply concerned about the direction that we're headed, especially in the area of taxes. And ladies and gentlemen, you better start planning for it, in my opinion, because most people I find when they retire are not in a lower tax bracket. What do you find, Ben?
If traditional planning has always said, you know, defer, defer, defer. Why? Because when you retire, well, you'll be at 2/3 of your income because of your pension. And, you know, in the past, Social Security wasn't taxed, which is certainly not the case anymore. But traditional planning, that doesn't work anymore, Paul. You're right. We've got a plan, and I certainly hope that when I retire, I'm at a higher tax bracket than I am right now. Otherwise, I didn't do it right. And I know you say the same thing for your clients. And
I don't say to clients what I don't do personally. And, you know, just like you've been, I know you're a quality guy in that regard as well. We practice what we preach. And look, I'm going to pay a substantial tax bill because I've been blessed this year. But I'd rather pay the tax bill this year than pay five times that 25 years from now when I'm pulling the money out in retirement.
Exactly. You're exactly right. And in retirement, that's a time when you want to be visiting with the grandkids, taking up those new hobbies and traveling. you don't want to be worrying about outliving your income because of an excess tax bill that the government's imposed.
Or you don't want to worry about the market and going and becoming a Walmart greeter because you had all your money tied up in the market instead of putting in an income for life models and doing some prudent planning. Anyway, with that, I got a little bit of time left. Real quick, sources. Great source. Pirates of Manhattan. Great book. Really pulls back the curtain on the insurance and industry. Last Chance Millionaire. Another wonderful book. Misfortune 101. You can get a hold of our office and we can, in fact, these are all books on our recommended reading list on financialabundanceinc.com. What would be other sources, Ben, that you would recommend?
You know, I found that a book by, a couple books by Len Renier, Sudden Impact, is a tremendous book talking about more
week.
Of the future, where we're heading, and how to prepare for that, as is Unintended Consequences, also by Len Renier. Misfortune 101, like you mentioned, in addition to Last Chance Millionaire, also by Doug Andrew.
And
those
by the
are some
way,
tremendously good reads, and they talk a lot about these, like you mentioned, contrarian strategies.
Yeah, and they're all good books, and I don't know if they can get Lynn's in the bookstore. I know they can get Doug's. Pirates of Manhattan, you have to get directly from Barry Dyke's website, but Lynn's going to be on the show next week.
At least perfect, he's slated sure he'll to. Show you how to get a hold of that book.
Yeah, he's slated to. If we're scheduled, but you know how stuff happens sometimes. But we're supposed to have Lynn on next week, and we're going to really talk about. I mean, here's a guy that's in some of the Washington think tanks. He sees what's going on, right?
Absolutely, and that's why you know we've partnered with Lynn just because he really he sought us out and said, look. These are the worries. These are the scares that I have when I'm talking to these think tanks. You provide the solutions. The people that you work with provide these solutions, and so it's really become a great fit. And his stuff is, I'll tell you, it's scary, Paul. When you look at it, it really causes concern.
I've studied his stuff, and I've met Lynn. I like him. I've got to run here. We're out of time. Ben Nevigen, San Diego Life Pro, thank you so much for your time and expertise. We appreciate it. You've been listening to the Investor Coach, Paul Nichols. Have a super duper holiday weekend. We hope this is going to air Christmas weekend. We hope this finds you all well, and we'll talk to you soon. Have a great day.